Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with indications that the bombings in Boston were acts of domestic terrorism and speak with Mark Potok, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of their Hate Watch blog. We will discuss the rampant speculation surrounding the bombings and try to assess possible motives for domestic terrorist groups to engage in an act whose sole purpose seems to be to kill Americans. Then we will speak with Dan Kennedy, who is a regular panelist on Beat the Press, a weekly roundtable program on media issues on WGBH-TV in Boston, to get a sense of how the city is dealing with this shocking tragedy and how its citizens are responding to comforting victims and their families and efforts by law enforcement to investigate who was behind the bombings. Dan Kennedy has an article at CNN, "Our Greatest Day Turns to Horror." And then we will discuss China's release of a defense white paper revealing the structure of its military with China expert June Dreyer, professor of political science at the University of Miami, who specializes in Chinese government and foreign policy and U.S. defense policy. She's the author of China's Political System, Modernization, and Tradition. Then finally, we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela to get an update on the tense and polarized situation following the very close election that has the winner, Maduro, accusing American imperialists of sabotaging the results. Meanwhile, the loser, Capriles, is demanding a recount and has called off the planned rally to protest the results on Wednesday that the government has said it would not allow. Virginia Lopez, who covers Latin America and Venezuela for the UK Guardian and Sky TV, joins us. Joining us now is Mark Potok, director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Mark Potok acts as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He's testified before the Senate, the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, and other venues. The Southern Poverty Law Center recently released a new report, The Return of the Militias, which documents how, after vanishing for nearly 10 years, the anti-government militia movement is surging across the country, fueled by fears of a black president, the changing demographics of the country, and fringe conspiracy theories increasingly spread by mainstream figures. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Potok.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
And, Mark, obviously there are reasons for some people to speculate that, first of all, it seems to be the consensus of from the news, which, of course, one can't believe, and the government is being very careful, the president's being very careful about releasing information, but that doesn't mean that there's rampant speculation, and it seems to be more and more centering on a consensus that this was an act of domestic terrorism. Is that your understanding?
Well, I don't know if there's a consensus. I get the sense just from listening, from talking to reporters all day long, that people on Background are saying to reporters that they're leaning at least somewhat towards some kind of domestic source. Now, you know, what I've not heard anywhere is, what does that mean? You know, does that mean the domestic radical right? Does it mean conceivably some kind of domestic radicalized Muslim? Does it mean another Adam Lanza, some sort of crazed, you know, single mass murderer who, you know, wants to be on TV, wants to be famous for 5 minutes? That I certainly don't know. And I think truly the evidence is mixed. It's not all that clear to me that the answer is obvious.
Well, this hasn't stopped, of course, a lot of speculation on the right in this country, accusing Muslims of being involved, as what happened back in 1995 with the Oklahoma City bombing, until it was found that it was a homegrown terrorist, Timothy McVeigh. You recall people like Emerson were saying it was Jordanians, etc. And now you have Fox News commentator Eric Rush sending out tweets, let's kill them, referring to the Muslims. And Pamela Geller, the anti-Muslim blogger, is talking about jihad in America. Pat Robertson on the 700 Club is saying, don't talk to me about the religion of peace, the way Muslims describe their faith, no way. So clearly that thread is out there, at least amongst some people on the, in the in the.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, Ian, that it's not merely people blaming it on Muslims. It is, you know, every, it seems like large numbers of the really fringe characters in our world, in our society, are basically blaming whoever their particular hated enemy is. So we've already seen some of the anti-immigration groups saying it's an immigrant or it's immigrants. If we didn't let those people, those sort of dirty foreigners into our country, you know, this wouldn't have happened. We've got Alex Jones, this kind of uber conspiracy theorist who has a radio show out of Austin, Texas, saying what he seems to say about just about every big attack or disaster, which is this is a false flag operation by the government. What's really going on is the government murdered all those people and set off those bombs so that it could use them as an excuse to crush people like Alex Jones, sort of liberty-loving patriots and all that good stuff.
Right. And
this is exactly what Alex Jones says about virtually everything. It's what the radical right said about the Oklahoma City bombing. So, you know, these characters out there are simply making the events fit their particular, bigoted framework, their particular view of the world, without a scrap of evidence to support them. I mean, it just shows how really bankrupt these people are.
And, of course, this Alex Jones character is one of the main protagonists of the 9/11 conspiracy theories.
That's right.
So, in terms of this week is a significant week, is it not, for the very right-wing militia movement in this country?
It is. And that is what's kind of driven some of the speculation about this attack coming from the domestic radical right. The point was made many times today in the newspapers and radio shows and so on that Monday in Massachusetts was Patriots Day, quote unquote. And it is true that Patriots Day is a kind of iconic day on the calendar of the radical right in this country. But for them, Patriots Day is the date of April 19th. April 19th is significant in their minds because it was the day of the opening shots of the American Revolutionary War in Lexington and Concord. It was the day of the beginning of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943. It was the day in 1985 of a major FBI raid of a big white supremacist compound in northwest Missouri, a place called the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord. It was the day, of course, of the end of the Waco standoff when the building burst into flames and about 80 of the cultists inside with their children died. And most importantly, the day of the Oklahoma City bombing exactly 2 years after the Waco debacle in 1995. So, you know, it is an important day, but it is not, but April 19th was in fact not Monday. The reality is that Massachusetts celebrates Patriots Day as a state holiday, and they do so, of course, because Lexington and Concord are in Massachusetts, so it's a big deal in that state. And the way they've set it up is the holiday in Massachusetts is the third Monday in April. So I think it's a bit far out, the idea that, April 19th, of course, is Friday. So it just seems very unlikely that someone on the radical right would be trying to send a message about what April 19th meant and so on by setting off a series of bombs on April 15th. It's possible. It is a very important day in their world. But it seems rather strange. I mean, I have never seen anyone on the extreme right talk about the third Monday in April. They all talk about April 19th, the date of which, they all know. It's kind of stamped on their frontal lobes.
Well, and of course, even though McVeigh indiscriminately killed Americans and children, as is the case in this atrocity in Boston, it normally targeted the radical right normally targets federal buildings or symbols of federal power. So that's a bit confusing in this case.
I think there's really something to that. I mean, when I think about the various attacks that have been carried out over the last 20 or 30 years by the radical right, They were atrocities, certainly, but one could at least, as a kind of intellectual matter, understand the targets. As you said, the typical targets, they're abortion clinics, they're gay nightclubs, they are federal buildings. In the case of Timothy McVeigh, I mean, McVeigh killed people who mostly had no relationship to the government at all, Social Security recipients, children, and so on. But even so, one could understand he was targeting the federal government, who he held responsible for what he saw as a mass murder in Waco. And the list goes on. And there was a bomber a few years ago who tried to kill as many as 1,500 marchers on Martin Luther King Day near Spokane, Washington. All of these kinds of targets, you can understand what they're trying to say with their terrorism. In the case of the Boston Marathon, who was really targeted? It was not the government. It was not the IRS, despite the fact that it was tax day on Monday. It was not any particular minority group. It wasn't black people or gay people or Jewish people or immigrants or Muslims. It was really, it seems to me, when you look at the victims or the people who were targeted generally in Boston, the only thing that really unites them is they were Americans. They weren't even of any particular social class. So it really was a rather hodgepodge group of people. And so I'm just arguing that it's a little hard. I'm not saying that I think it didn't come from the radical right. I think we just don't know that. But the target is difficult to understand if that was the case.
Well, Mark Potok, of course, what we do know is that the bombs were pressure cooker bombs, explosives, simple explosives, gunpowder, surrounded by ball bearings and nails inside of pressure cookers, inside of backpacks left in trash cans or trash containers. And they are, of course, IEDs, improvised explosive device, I guess, in the broad sense. They have a history. The short-lived Al-Qaeda magazine Inspire apparently put up how-to information about these bombs. The 2010 SUV bomb in New York's Times Square was a pressure cooker bomb was using firecrackers and 120 firecrackers. But apparently the Inspire tipsters how to build these bombs did in fact members of at least one prominent white supremacist website shared these terror tips and called them highly recommended reading, and also this was also discussed in detail on an anarchist site describing how to build pressure cooker bombs as what they affectionately call hellhounds.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that it's these pressure cooker bombs are at all limited to the places where they're commonly thought, there's a lot of us being common, Pakistan, India, and places like that, where pressure cookers are, in fact, very commonly used to cook. I think the reality is it's quite an easy bomb to build. It's very easy to get information on it off the Internet and to essentially follow instructions on the Internet to pull this off. I remember seeing in 2010 there was a Department of Homeland Security circular sent around to law enforcement agencies warning them of these pressure cooker bombs. They mentioned their foreign use, but also were warning about their use domestically and not necessarily by jihadists or something of that stripe. I think the reality is the Internet has made many, many kinds of weapons, especially these relatively easy weapons to build, very much available to almost anyone. It just does not take that much skill to assemble some of these bombs with the Internet at your fingertips. These are not specialized weapons. I think that's probably a reason not to see that may be evidence that it's more likely domestic than foreign in origin. Because I think, if you had a foreign plot, a foreign-based plot like this, I think you would expect to see a very sophisticated plot with sophisticated bombs and so on. If people were going to come all the way over here, get into the country and do everything that it takes to set up an attack like this, I think it would have been much, much more sophisticated, as I say, than it was. But in fact, this looked quite a lot in some ways like a kind of homegrown operation. I mean, that doesn't tell us what the ideology of the bomber may have been, but it does suggest that perhaps that person or those persons were in fact Americans.
Well, Mark Potok, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Potok, who's director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as the spokesperson for the Southern Poverty Law Center, and it has recently released a new report, The Return of the Militias, which documents how, after vanishing for nearly 10 years, the anti-government militia movement is surging across the country, fueled by fears of a black president, the changing demographics of the country, and fringe conspiracy theories increasingly spread by mainstream figures. And joining us now is Dan Kennedy, who's a professor at Northeastern University School of Journalism. He is a regular panelist on Beat the Press, a weekly roundtable program on media issues on WGBH-TV in Boston. And from 2007 to 2011, he wrote a weekly online column for the UK Guardian's Comments is Free America section. He blogs at Media Nation, is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and the Boston Phoenix, and has an article at CNN, Our Greatest Day Turns to Horror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Kennedy.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And your piece is at CNN, Our Greatest Day Turns to Horror, really explains to me as an outsider the deep feelings that Bostonians feel towards this day, this Patriots Day, and how it's celebrated with this America's oldest marathon, and it's so you're saying here that that it's deep in the civics psyche of Boston.
It really is. For people who are not familiar with Boston or Massachusetts, the marathon is the most important event on Patriots Day, but it's really just part of what is this enormous family-oriented holiday, where it's a holiday, it's a day off from work, where you can go watch reenactments of the Colonials fighting against the Redcoats. You've got the Red Sox having their once a year, they have an 11 a.m. game so that the baseball crowds don't get in the way of the marathon crowds. And then finally, you just get thousands and thousands of people lining the 26.2-mile marathon route from Hopkinton to Boston. And the reason that so many people are able to get out there and watch the marathon is indeed because it's a holiday. So it's just been this wonderful tradition, and it has been irrevocably altered, I'm afraid.
And it's a holiday involving lots of school children, right? It's the first day of the spring vacation.
That's right. I mean, it's their first day out of school, and so that adds to it, and that certainly explains why so many kids are on the scene, including Martin Richard, the 8-year-old boy who was killed, and his sisters who were so badly injured. So I mean, it's if anybody had wanted to pick I hate to even use the word better, but a better time and place to carry out an act of terror like this, they couldn't have done any better than this. I mean, this was just really a place that everybody was watching around here, and everybody was just completely horrified and by what happened.
And of course, it's obviously I was just speaking then with Mark Potok, who follows the right-wing militia movements in this country, and it's incomprehensible to figure out what the motives were in this case, because of the victims were all Americans. That's the only thing they had in common, except the event itself, the marathon, is incredibly international. You saw all those flags of almost every nation on the earth. There's people in this race, has it not?
Well, that's true, but at the same time, the people who have dominated the winner's circle in recent years tend to be from East Africa, from Kenya, from Ethiopia, and those countries. And certainly I'm not aware of any terrorist inclination against people from East Africa. Right? That seems like at least in the United States, that seems like a fairly uncontroversial part of the world. So it's a little difficult to imagine that it was the runners that anyone was trying to hurt. And indeed, the runners were not hurt because the bomb was not, the two bombs were not close enough to where they were running through. It seems that it was clearly aimed at the spectators and at killing and injuring as many of them as possible.
Again, I'm speaking with Dan Kennedy, professor at Northeastern University School of Journalism and a regular panelist on Beat the Press, a weekly roundtable program on media issues on WGBH-TV in Boston. And he has an article at CNN, Our Greatest Day Turns to Horror. Obviously, there was no way in the world that law enforcement could protect this route. I mean, it's not – nobody obviously ever thought that this would happen.
I would push back on that a little bit. I think that for many years now, and especially since 9/11, anybody who's really thought about this has thought that a big open sporting event of some kind would be vulnerable to this kind of attack. So I'm not sure that many people around here were completely shocked that something like this would happen. Of course, it's always shocking when it happens, but it is the sort of thing that in the aftermath of 9/11 you did hear people talk about. But the point you make is exactly right. It's a huge open event. I mean, there's very little security that you can do over a 26-mile route. Now, they do have more security at the finish line, which is where the bombing occurred. So you can see that even with the additional security that they have when the runners come in past the finish line, there was really only so much they could do. And I suspect it's going to be a lot more lockdown in the future. But at the same time, again, I do wonder how much they can do given the nature of the event.
And in terms of how the Boston is responding to both the victims and their families, what's your sense of the city that you observe and comment on, Dan Kennedy?
Well, I think that we've seen this in other attacks like this. Certainly, New York pulled together after 9/11. After some of these horrible mass murders like Sandy Hook in Aurora, Colorado, I think that we saw those communities pull together. And I think we're seeing that now in Boston, too. I mean, one of the stories that people keep repeating is that some of the runners, upon crossing the finish line and hearing about this, just kept right on going to the hospital so that they could give blood. And many people were letting it be known on the internet last night that runners who were stuck in Boston as a result of this could stay at their homes. And I think there's been a real outpouring over the, well, certainly the one victim whose name was released the earliest, Martin Richard, and I think that we're going to see the same outpouring over the other two victims as they become better known.
Well, I've only seen the picture of the young woman who was killed, and it's, you know, it's heartbreaking to see such a joyous looking young woman be victimized.
Absolutely.
In this way.
And it turns out she was a waitress at a restaurant my wife were at a couple of weeks ago. I mean, it's a small town. That's the other thing about this that I think that your listeners should know. Boston is a small town, and everybody knows everybody. I think all of us knew people who were running in the marathon. And as soon as this happened, you could get onto Facebook and immediately see people checking in and saying, you know, I'm okay. Is so-and-so accounted for? We all know people who were running. Many of us have given money to the causes that they were running to represent so that they would be able to get entry to the marathon. So as large an event as this is, it's also very intimate, and it's something that we're all connected to.
So just in closing, Dan Kennedy, is there any sense in Boston on the ground where this investigation's heading?
You know,
I know that within the last few hours, the police said that they recovered the circuit board that may have been used in triggering the bombs. So I think that the media here have been very good about not speculating as to who was behind this and what the motive may have been. Certainly, some of the speculation that you saw about the young Saudi national really did not infect the local media around here, and I think that's to their credit. But I do think there's a sense that the authorities are moving pretty quickly on a number of fronts, and certainly a great hope that a suspect or suspects will be identified in the next day or two or three. Certainly, if that doesn't happen, you're probably going to start to see frustration begin to set in, regardless of how difficult this task is for law enforcement.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dan Kennedy.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Dan Kennedy. He's a professor at Northeastern University School of Journalism. He's a regular panelist on Beat the Press, a weekly roundtable program on media issues on WGBH-TV in Boston. And from 2007 to 2011, wrote a weekly online column for the UK Guardian's Comet is Free America section. He blogs at Media Nation, is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and the Boston Phoenix, and has an article at CNN, Our Greatest Day Turns to Horror. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about China's release of a defense white paper revealing the structure of its military. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is June Teufel-Dreyer, who is a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asia-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, June Teufel-Dreyer.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And this release of this defense white paper by the Chinese government revealing its army structure is being seen as a step towards transparency. Is that the way you see it?
No. It is, in fact, boggling the mind that anyone would see it as a step toward transparency. It reads more like a blueprint for rationalization for China's aggressive actions that it's been taking in the last couple of years.
And just quickly go through them, the aggressive actions.
In the East China and South China Sea, with regard to Japan, with regard to the Philippines, with regard to Vietnam, with regard to when the Philippines and Indonesia attempted to bring their concerns before the Asia-Pacific Forum, the Chinese put pressure on the host of the forum, Laos, which Laos is economically dependent on them, and they resisted putting the item on the agenda. This is what I call aggressive behavior, and I don't see anything in this white paper that would convince me that there's anything like transparency here.
So in terms of the budget, though, it's risen by the China's defense budget. It's risen by 11.2% in 2002, and it exceeds 100 billion U.S. But that pales in comparison, of course, to the U.S. defense budget.
Well, it does, although costs are much cheaper in China. And the United States has a global presence to keep the sea lanes of communication open, whereas China is under no such constraints. In essence, it freeloads, just as other nations freeloaded on Britain's dominance of the seas in the 19th century.
So, June Teufel-Dreyer, is this the Chinese military budget, which has alarms a lot of conservatives here in the United States, and is it really a product of China's economic miracle, if you will, of its booming economy? In other words, as the economy booms, then a certain percentage of that money would go to defense. So therefore, the stronger the economy, the more money defense gets.
Another absurd argument, because China has huge unfunded problems. Its education budget is very straitened. Its health care is upsetting. It's one of the least equitable healthcare systems in the world, as judged by Médecins Sans Frontières, which is not an American organization. Its press is the least free, one of the least free in the world. I think Kazakhstan may be a little worse. And it is doing nothing to really address these health and education problems. And so we are supposed to say, well, it doesn't matter. The economy is going up by 11%, which, by the way, it isn't. So the defense budget can go up by 11%. Because in years when the economy has dipped, the defense budget has gone right up anyway. And then you have to ask yourself, given these really crying needs among the population, and China has no external enemy ready to attack, how you rationalize these large increases in the defense budget? I, for one, cannot.
So when the Chinese this government says that its unshakable national commitment is to take the road of peaceful development, you don't buy that?
No. Meanwhile, it's bullying all its neighbors.
And what do you think's going on vis-a-vis North Korea? I mean, they're supposedly being more helpful, and although I'm not sure what the evidence is.
Yes, I'm not sure where the evidence is either. But in the case of North Korea, the Chinese really do have a dilemma. They, I think, if you will permit a medical analogy, what they want is to keep the North Korean patient on life support. They don't really want it to get well. They like the idea of a divided Korea because Koreans are notably independent, and a united Korea would be much more difficult to keep under Chinese dominance. At the moment, Chinese diplomacy has done a very excellent job of playing the North Koreans off against the South Koreans. And were unification to happen, that would become much more difficult, as well as risk the Korean Peninsula becoming a bit too independent. I don't think the Koreans are ever going to side with the United States strongly or with Japan strongly or with anybody else strongly, but they would not side with China strongly either, which is not what China wants. Meanwhile, North Korea is dependent on it.
Again, I'm speaking with June Teufel-Dreyer, who's a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in Chinese government and foreign policy and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. So the fact that China's military, some of the big ticket items, its aircraft, for example, the homegrown aircraft apparently aren't particularly good, although I believe it's buying some much better Russian aircraft, Russian fighter planes. It has the one and only aircraft carrier it has it bought from the Ukraine, and it has also maintained a fairly low number of nuclear weapons, strategic nuclear weapons. I don't know the exact figure, but it's never been anything like what the U.S. and Russia has. So do that apparent restraint, does that count at all?
I don't know what you mean by restraint.
Well, in other words, we have thousands of nuclear weapons.
I don't call this restraint. They have a very credible minimum deterrent. They have a second strike capability. And meanwhile, they are expanding on several fronts. Their aircraft are getting increasingly more sophisticated. Takes a long time to master aircraft carrier technology, but they've done an extremely good job of it. Just an amazingly good job of it. And with the money and the effort they're devoting to it, I think there's no doubt they're going to get quite a bit better in the near future.
But just doing the bean counting of our nuclear weapons, and after all, the National Security Advisor has just been over in Russia trying to make a deal to reduce the number of weapons we have. But we've got thousands. I don't believe they have any more than hundreds. So do you have the figures?
Consider the base they started with, and consider how fast they are expanding that base.
So, when you say they have a robust second strike capability, what would their first strike be aimed at?
Well, they have said they will never be the ones to use a first strike, but you have to parse that very carefully. I can imagine they would under certain circumstances. And they'll always have a rationalization. Countries always do, not just China. But what would be the target? I imagine it would be something controlled by the United States. Perhaps Kadena Air Force Base in Okinawa.
So, June Teufeldreihe, in terms of who controls the military, with this white paper, which, well, as you pointed out or suggested, it was somewhat absurd to think that this was an example of a new kind of transparency. But the new Chinese leader there was some doubt when he was taking over in the transition period, of course, which was overshadowed by a lot of scandals. And, of course, the New York Times and Bloomberg released stories about how much money these leaders have stashed away with their families, billions of dollars. And that was obviously somewhat embarrassing for the leadership. Xi Jinping, the new leader, he is there was some doubt as to whether he would get the military portfolio, that the outgoing Secretary General will keep it. What's the story behind that?
There definitely was a high-level power struggle going on. Hu Jintao, the leader who has just left, belonged to what the Chinese call the Tuan Pai, the Communist Youth League faction. And Jiang Zemin before Hu Jintao and Xi Jinping afterwards are more from the coastal China wealthier areas. Xi Jinping is known as a princeling. Both he and his wife have impeccable parentage, revolutionary parentage, and they are more the elite group than the Hu Jintao did. And so we think Hu Jintao, who never really managed to ingratiate himself with the military the way Jiang Zemin did, and Xi Jinping almost grew up in with the scions of these other military families, also had very good connections. So we, as best we know, he managed to outmaneuver Hu Jintao on this one, and was able to take that military portfolio immediately. And, you know, it was not a happy situation for most Chinese when you had Hu Jintao being commander-in-chief of the armed forces, even while Jiang Zemin remained in charge of the Central Military Commission. The Chinese used to refer to it as the two centers of power, and they were really very uncomfortable with it. So I think that made it easier for Xi Jinping to get both portfolios.
Well, there's always been questions about how much the civilians control the military, how autonomous and certainly how opaque the military is. And their questions now have been arising because of an apparent shift with China vis-a-vis North Korea, that this is a sort of struggle between the foreign ministry on the one hand, who want a more enlightened approach to international relations and regional relations, and the military, who who are sort of more stuck in the past. Now, what do you know about the civilian control, and are there competing power centers within the Chinese structure?
I do believe there are competing power centers, but I do not think this is a matter of the foreign ministry versus the defense ministry. The Chinese foreign ministry has historically been very weak. There is no evidence that it has gotten any stronger. Real concern, I think, is within the military, and there are factions within the military which seem to mirror factions within the civilian leadership. In other words, there are hardliners in the military who liaise and speak with hardliners in the civilian leadership, and the same thing for the so-called doves in the military who have friends in the Standing Committee of the Politburo who feel the way they do.
So, under Deng Xiaoping, where he apparently decided in order to pay for the military budget that the, and you know, his great motto was to be rich is glorious, and the idea was that the military were encouraged to get into private enterprise or enterprises, I guess, in order to defray the costs of the military budget. And apparently in those days, the military was dominated by the Yang family, and they got deep into all kinds of commercial ventures all around the world, including pirate logging in Papua New Guinea and places like that. So where does that stand today in terms of
Jiang Zemin ordered the military out of commerce. And like a lot of other things in China, it worked, but only partially. And so the military remains to some extent with its business interests. And Deng Xiaoping's idea that the military should engage in civilian enterprises really went a long way toward fostering the growth of corruption within the military, and they're still struggling with that.
So they're not totally out of it in terms of
That is correct. And you know, if all of Chinese society is very corrupt. It's endemic in the system, and it is very difficult to get the PLA, even if you were somehow to remove them completely from the commercial sphere, which has not been done. But even if you had managed that, they still have to have large supplies of petroleum, because they need it for their vehicles and weapons, and you can always sell those in the private market.
Well, but isn't, just in closing, Teufeldry, isn't corruption the real problem there? My understanding is that the top 200 people in the Chinese government, the combined wealth is something like $89.9 billion, and if you compare that to the United States, where the combined wealth of the president, his cabinet, the Senate, the House, and the Supreme Court, I believe, is about $7.4 billion. Mm-hmm. So and $120 billion apparently has been salted away overseas with the families. The Chinese word for them is naked officials. They get their kids out, get them educated, and they park their money. So, how is it really as bad as recent reports indicate?
Yeah, it may even be worse, because the New York Times and Bloomberg discovered is documents proving this. And these are believed to be the tip of the iceberg kind of thing. So there's a lot out there that remains to be discovered. There was a story in the Chinese press a few days ago that at the National People's Congress, which was in March, delegates discussed making the assets of the NPC members known. In other words, just as the President of the United States and his cabinet and members of Congress have to make their tax returns known, the Chinese party members and the National People's, which is the state operation, would have to make their assets public. And the delegates said, no, this would not be a good idea, because if they were forced to divulge, it would be bad for social stability. And bear in mind that a number of members of Congress are already wealthy before they get there because they have been successful trial lawyers or physicians or something like that. A couple of them are even Rockefellers. In other words, they were wealthy before they got there. These Chinese officials allegedly had to live on their official salaries before they become members of the National People's Congress, and those are very low salaries. So how, except through corruption, could they have amassed these fortunes?
Well, Jun Teufeldreyer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Very interesting. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Jun Teufeldreyer, who's a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asia-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. We're going to take a brief station break and be back and go to Caracas, Venezuela to get an update on the polarized post-election tension.
Porque está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Virginia Lopez, who is a journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And I believe since the elections, 7 people have been killed and 61 have been injured in post-election violence across Venezuela, and 135 people have been arrested in connection with this political violence. What's your sense of how unstable or tense is this very polarized country?
Well, it certainly looked this afternoon like we were headed towards a major crisis. There were, nonstop broadcasts by all sorts of government officials, including the Minister of Defense and, of course, President Maduro and President of the National Assembly, Diosdado Cabello, warning the opposition of not trying to launch a similar coup to that which took place in 2002. The warnings, you know, would escalate from threats to you know, also calling to peace. But certainly, you know, this sort of monopoly of the airwaves was quite reminiscent of what did indeed happen in April of 2002 when there was a coup. So for a moment there, you know, we thought that yes, tomorrow's march to the CNE, which was called by Enrique Capriles, would probably, you know, have a terrible ending. Capriles has since gone on TV to call off the march, which Maduro had previously banned. Anyway, so, you know, so what seemed to have been this sort of foretold confrontation seems to have been minimized for now.
So when you refer, Virginia Lopez, when you refer this to the April, back in the 2002 coup, there are two stages to that coup, right? There were competing street demonstrations and then the actual coup itself, which of course turned out to be a bit of a farce. Are the Maduro and the Chavistas, are they is the subtext to what they're warning, is that to do with this belief that the coup was conducted by the Bush White House, and which may well be the truth, knowing how incompetent Bush and Cheney were. But when you have people like the president of Venezuela's National Assembly saying, "Fascist Capriles, I will personally see that you pay for all of the damage that you're doing to our homeland and our people." I mean, it's pretty heated rhetoric that's going on. So I guess the good news is they've canceled the street demonstrations, but the bad news is that the accusations are quite poisonous between the winners and losers of this very close elections.
Yes, certainly the accusations have been flying on both directions. But of course, you know, Maduro is in power, so his seem to carry, you know, bigger weight. Maduro has indeed said that the U.S. was backing a new coup that was, you know, in the making as we speak, or that is in the making as we speak. He named officials. He went on to say that the two U.S. embassy officials that he expelled in early March after Chavez's death had been, you know, again, he reiterated that they've been here planning a coup. So again, you know, again, a replay of the 2002 situation. Capriles similarly has, you know, has put the blame on Maduro. He has insisted that he has information that tomorrow's march would have been infiltrated by agitators from the Chavista camp in order to, you know, provoke a larger political crisis that would have probably ended in bloodshed. So yes, you know, like you said, there's been accusations on both sides. Capriles has also said that the slim margin that resulted in Sunday's election has not been read accurately by the government, who keeps on, you know, trying to set one half of the country against the other half. You know, so this still it has a potential to escalate.
And the margin is Maduro got 50.8% of the votes in Sunday's elections, and the opposition candidate Enrique Capriles won 49%. So you have Capriles on the one hand calling for a recount, and then on the other side, Maduro is saying that the American imperialists rigged the vote and somehow impenetrated the voting machines.
Capriles is saying several things. He's asking for a recount for an absolute 100% ballot manual count. To be compared with the manual acts that get written. In the past, he's also made accusations that there was an unfair campaign trail. And another member of his party has also said that, you know, that it's very suspicious to find these remote populations in the country where there is zero abstention and where all of the population votes for for Chavez in the past. So there's several irregularities that they're claiming that occur, not only in terms of counting the vote, but also just in the practices surrounding the vote. So ironically, Maduro had accepted this vote count, but then on Sunday when he in his sort of acceptance speech, but then. But then his proclamation was, from what I hear, pushed one day forward so that he was proclaimed yesterday as opposed to today. And both he and other government officials and the CNE director, you know, completely denied that the possibility for a count was an option.
But hasn't he been suggesting, Maduro, that the narrow margin was the result of interference from the imperialists?
From what I gather, no. He's accusing the U.S. of heating the streets with these demonstrations, and of also of previously a financing student movement that were calling for a health report for Chavez's, mysterious illness and whereabouts. That was back when we didn't know, you know, what type of cancer he had or where he was, where there had been no proof of life other than the three photographs.
So when Maduro says the U.S. Embassy is the one who has financed and directed all the acts of violence in this country, it has financed these neo-Nazi groups, is he referring to before the elections or after the elections in terms of this election, post-election violence?
In today's statement, he referred to both. He referred to the CIA specifically funding student movements that had protested, the unfair conditions of the campaign trail, and also yesterday and today's street protests.
But how could he complain, Maduro, that the campaign was unfair when the Chavistas control almost all the media? Now they're going to be controlling the only piece of the media that's left that even reports on Capriles, which is Globovision. So what's he talking about?
There's a lot of things that Maduro say that contradict him. I think like you've said, this is the time of incendiary rhetoric. But again, Maduro has been blaming the CIA for funding student movements that the student movements were the ones denouncing the unfair campaign conditions, which Capriles had also gone out to denounce, specifically things like access to state funds, unlimited time on air in all of the state media, in the state-run media.
So this doesn't bode well, does it, for the future of your country, Virginia Lopez? It's highly polarized at the moment. The loser's calling for a recount. The winner is insulting the loser, and vice versa. How do you see this country moving forward, away from the polarization, into some kind of civic dialogue?
I don't know if the international community might have to step in. Again, this is, like you've described it really well, this is, again, an incredibly polarized society. We've all lived through this following the 2002 coup, and I think it's something that everybody at all levels is just tired of having to endure. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for the society. No country can survive this in such a short period of time. This is terrible.
Well, Virginia Lopez, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One more life.